This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Gary Disher has been a full-time writer since 1988 and has published more than 50 books across multiple genres, including general literary novels, crime thrillers, story collections, fiction for children and teenagers, anthologies as an editor, creative writing handbooks, and Australian history textbooks. He has a growing international reputation for his best-selling crime novels. He has won 4 German and 3 Australian awards for Best Crime Novel of the Year and been longlisted twice for a British CWA Dagger Award. In 1988, he received the Ned Kelly Lifetime Achievement Award.
We'll start at the very beginning. Has writing always been a part of your life?
Yes, I wanted to be a writer even as a child, and I think some aspects of my childhood account for it. For a start, there were always books in the house. I was a keen reader. I think that's a prerequisite to being a writer, is to be a reader. I used to teach creative writing to adults, and I know probably as many as 30% of my students didn't read. They wanted to be writers. They might have even been good storytellers, but they weren't readers.
That's always extraordinary to me.
Yeah, no, I'd say to them, you might like to read Helen Garner's The Children's Bark or something like that. And they say, who's Helen Garner? So that happened every year, something like that would happen. Also, I was isolated as a child in the sense that I grew up on a farm and I didn't see other kids after school and only to play football on the weekend. So I had younger siblings, but I didn't have much to do with them. So, you know, I was a daydreamer, lost in my own head all the time. And thinking of stories, thinking of adventures for myself, a creative internal world all the time. And my father was a great influence because he didn't read to us at bedtime, but told his own stories. So I had a sense of someone creating a sense of place, storyline, imagery, and all the rest of it. He was a great storyteller, a great gardener. And also, crucially, something about pacing, because he never ever finished these stories. He'd say, I'll finish this tomorrow night, son. So it's like coming to the end of the chapter and you're anxious to know what happens next, but you're frustrated that. And that's what writers do, I think, eternally frustrate the readers.
It is. That's a good framework to be working from. Do you remember the first thing that you had published?
Apart from little things in university magazines, film reviews and that sort of thing, and some short fiction, it was a short story about a bushfire that I sent to, because I'd just gone through a big bushfire with my father in the mid-north of South Australia, wheat and wool country where I grew up. I remember vividly being isolated from my father. We lost each other during the night. We were up all night fighting this fire in remote hills, and I lost my father, or we lost each other. So it made such a vivid impression on me that I wrote a short story about it. Not so much about the fire, but about the relations between the men and the women who were bringing sandwiches and drinks. Anyway, I sent it to Overland magazine, which is still going, and it's always had a brief to help support new writers. And they published it, and a year later I got a check for $100, and I thought, I'm a writer at last. The next few stories, typically for a beginner, were rejected. But bit by bit, I built up a little portfolio. And on the strength of them was awarded a creative writing scholarship to Stanford University in California near San Francisco. And that was the best thing that could have happened to me as a new writer. Gave me a real boost.
Was that the first sort of creative writing class that you'd been involved with?
Yeah. I would say to new writers, 1 year in a good class is all you need. When I taught creative writing at adult education and later home school and state college, I had students I would see year after year after year, and I did wonder what they were getting from it. But I wasn't about to criticise that, of course, but I think 1 year in a good class with a really good teacher and really, really good fellow students is enough. There was a class of about 12, we would meet twice a week for 2 hours and workshop the short stories or novel chapters we've been working on. And I learned a lot very quickly. You know, one of my fellow students, for example, had a few stories published in the New Yorker, which is the pinnacle back then, or probably still
even
is,
now.
Of being published, yeah. And when I came back to Victoria, I started teaching creative writing at adult education, and there wasn't much being taught back then. Carmel Bird was started teaching roughly the same time at adult education. But, you know, after that, TAFE colleges took up professional writing courses and university English departments and so on.
Well, you went on from that first initial university course to publish more than 50 books, which is an incredible number. What does your writing process look like? How do you write that many books?
I couldn't make a living as a writer for the first 10 or 15 years, so I taught. But I made sure I taught part-time, and I made sure that I only talked in the afternoons and evenings, which meant I had only the mornings to work in, which taught me good work habits. But it still took probably a couple of years to develop good work habits. I think that's a big thing I would say to beginner writers is develop work habits. It's better to do an hour a day than a burst of 6 hours on a weekend every 2 or 3 months. It's the regularity that you need. There's that regularity now, and I quit teaching to become a full-time writer, and instantly my income plummeted, but I was much happier. And so I write every morning. I write to a time deadline, not a word limit deadline. I think Peter Carey, I heard that he writes until he's got 1,000 or 1,500 words, but I just write from roughly 8 o'clock to 12 o'clock. I might produce a paragraph or I might produce 10 pages of scrawl. So that's my approach. I've been doing roughly 6 mornings a week, but during lockdown with nothing else to do, I've been writing 7 mornings a week.
And you write with a blue pen. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I've often heard this, and I think it's true, that writers can be quite superstitious. And the magic flies out the window if it's a black biro. So it has to be a blue biro on the backs of used manuscript pages. I don't buy fresh paper.
That's very environmentally friendly.
Oh, it is, yeah. It's also anal.
Potato, potato, isn't it? Yeah. Gary, in your book on writing fiction, you said that all writing is driven by a question. Do you know the question of the book that you're writing from the outset?
Not always, but if I have trouble, I'll ask myself, what question is driving this book? Sometimes it's a very simple question. For example, the Wyatt novels. One of my characters, I've written about 9 Wyatt novels now. Wyatt is a professional criminal. He robs banks, payroll vans. And the simple question that drives all those books is, will he get away with it? The Hirsch novels and several of my other books, there might be several questions driving the book. You know, there's a crime being committed. Who did it, for example, or why was it done? Which is a more interesting question often. So those sorts of questions might be driving the story. But I realise when I look back at those books, what's driving them is the search for a true home. My character Hirsch, for example, he's a city cop. He's young. He's been disgraced and busted down the uniform and sent to a one-officer police station in the outback. So in addition to learning about the circumstances of a crime that might occur, he has to learn about the setting. So it's a double tension for him. And he's uprooted. He doesn't feel comfortable there. He's an outsider. So I think that's one of the questions driving several of my books is a character searching for a true home. Always be a place. It could be the arms of a lover or a loved one, or it could be finding peace of mind. So I think if there's no question driving your story, you won't get very far. But sometimes you do have to stop and ask yourself, what is the question? What am I trying to solve here? What puzzle are you leaving with the reader?
I think that's a really useful way to think about it. I want to talk about crime writing specifically because I think you know a lot about it. If you look back at your career, do you think that crime novels and crime writing has changed over the time that you've been doing it?
Yeah, I think it has. I started roughly writing when people like the American writer Sarah Paretsky were writing in the United States in the 80s and 90s. And they had an enormous influence on crime writing. Before that, there were unrealistic characters like Agatha Christie's Miss Marple. Mm. Now, she is a super reasoning machine. She's not a character at all. She's just a brain on legs. She solves, she looks at the information, she works out what's happened. But there's no sense of an elderly parent that she's worried about. There's no sense of stale cheese in her fridge. There's no sense of her doubts and anxieties. The other type of crime character at that time is the hard-boiled Los Angeles detective. But on the first page, he's sitting in his desk, sitting behind his desk in his office. There's a bottle of scotch in the bottom drawer, and a woman with big breasts comes in and says, "I want you to find my missing husband." That's the kind of setup in those books. Again, there's no sense of a social context for these characters. They're not worried about the ailing powers of an elderly parent, for example. They don't have messy love lives. They don't have sisters who are always meeting the wrong kind of guy or whatever it might be. So Sarah Paretsky and some of those other American writers had enormous influence, where the main character was now someone like us. We could relate to them. Ultimately, they're not us. They step where we fear to tread as ordinary humans, but we can relate to them because we have messy love lives and so do they, and all those sorts of things. So that's one of the big shifts. I think, too, good crime fiction these days tells us about the world we live in, that I think in one regard, literary fiction has let us down in that aspect, because it might be full of gorgeous prose and fascinating themes and interesting characters, but nothing much happens, and you don't learn. As crime novels, they explore prevailing social tensions, for example, corruption, homophobia, racism, the effects of poverty on crime. That's one of the things I explore in my Hirsch novels and in my Peninsula series of novels, how crime is often driven by social distress and social inequality. I don't really beat the reader over the head with a message, but I'm interested in those underlying driving forces in my stories. So there are a couple of the main things that I've noticed.
A really key part of crime writing, and probably any writing really, I think, is tension. How do you think about tension in your work?
Yeah, I do. I think about it a lot. You can use simple tactics, for example, like ending each chapter on a high point. The reader barely, you know, there's a knock on the door just when you're, you know, someone in the middle of the night on a dirt road. That's the end of that chapter. So, of course, that immediate tension. Who's knocking on the door? Does it pose danger? So you use simple techniques like that. I love a quote by Charles Dickens. He says, "Make him laugh, make him cry, make him wait." And that's a crucial thing. The reader badly wants to know, but you frustrate that desire. You use withholding tactics and delaying tactics. You get them to exercise their mind about the wrong issue. You have turning points just when things are going really swimmingly well for the main character. You pull the rug out from under their feet. Those sorts of things, they're terrific for creating tension and suspense. But there's also voice matters. I use two sorts of voices, if you like. My Wyatt novels and my Peninsula police procedurals use multiple viewpoints, so that the reader often knows more than the main character what's going on. See, Wyatt, for example, he forms a gang perhaps to rob a bank, but meanwhile some gang members are operating against him. And he doesn't know that, but the reader does. So that's very useful. Then on the other hand, though, with my Hirsch novels and a couple of other recent novels, including the new one that's just come out, The Way It Is Now, I don't take the reader anywhere but into the mind of the main character. So as the main character puzzles about what's going on, so does the reader. So they're both quite different approaches, but they're both useful for creating tension.
You mentioned one device as getting the reader to exercise their mind on the wrong issue. What does that look like?
The wrong person or the wrong reason.
Right.
It's just another word for it, of course, is red herring.
That's great.
It has to be plausible, though. I think not just a nonsense red herring, because Gary Disher said red herrings really work well. It has to really be plausible, given what's already happened and given who these characters are. It just happens to be the wrong reason why something happens.
In terms of crime and research, I'm assuming you don't have a criminal sub-life. How do you come up with the crimes that end up in your novels?
It's interesting you should say I don't have a criminal sub-life because when the Wyatt novels first came out, the producers of Police Rescue in Sydney took up the option and sent a scriptwriter down to meet with me. And he was a really strange guy. I picked him up at the Frankston Railway Station and took him down to where I live in a rural area of the Mornington Peninsula. And he was tense the whole time. And he later revealed when I took him back to the Frankston Station that he thought I was a crim, that I'd turned straight and happened that I was now writing about my experience.
Oh, my God. And yet he still went with you. Like, what a brave thing to do.
He was a lot bigger than me, but he was a bundle of nerves. you ask where I get my ideas from. So
well, research. Research as well. Research, the police side of things, I think, is...
Yeah, I've gone to police stations and asked, you know, what... For example, with the Peninsula novels, there are police procedurals. The main town is called Waterloo, which is based on Hastings, but I couldn't call it Hastings for in case I wanted to invent an international airport or something. But I went there and asked, now, who's in charge of the station? I thought it might be an inspector, but no, it's a senior sergeant. And is there a canteen? Is there a lockup? How many detectives are there? Are there any civilian workers? I needed to know all these things because often there are scenes set in the police station and they were very helpful. I think the police often feel maligned and they like it if someone takes an interest. And you want to get it right. At the same time, though, I make things up and I use Google. I use my brother. He's a retired country cop for the Hirsch novel set in the mid-north of South Australia where I grew up. What's it like for a country cop? Because he used to make patrols on, you know, four-wheel drive over several hundred kilometres some days in that out dry country where he worked. So I searched when necessary.
I imagine your readers also tell you if you get it wrong. Can you think of any details people have told you that
quick,
you were...
Yeah, they're quick to tell you if you get it wrong. With the Wyatt novels, I had Wyatt one day steal a safe from a lawyer's office, a Chubb, I think it was the brand name. It's a brand name of safes. And someone pointed out to me that the safe probably would have been cemented into the floor and not so easily stolen. But I wasn't too fussed about that. But one day I got this phone call. I don't know how this guy found me from Tasmania. And we all know about the Tasmanian gun laws many years ago. He said, you got some detail wrong about a handgun. That particular handgun does not have a safety on it. If you like, next time you're down in Tasmania, I'll take you out to the range and you can shoot my 357 Magnum and my Glock and my Beretta. No thanks. And there's a man in Melbourne who loved the Wyatt novels, but he said, now you've got Wyatt catching a tram on the corner of X and Y Street. In fact, the tram stop is 100 metres down the road.
Oh, wow.
But I didn't think I had to go to Melbourne to research that somehow.
It's impressive. Coming back to your book on writing, Gary, you wrote, writing can be a world of envy, disappointment and depression for all writers. I love this, and I think a lot of our listeners who are also writers will be able to relate. How do you manage those feelings in yourself? I can recap them. Envy, disappointment.
Yeah. I was certainly early in my career, and I think new writers will feel this too, is the sense of sadness or depression or frustration if a book gets rejected, for example, or you think it's better than the book that was won a particular prize, or you wonder why you never get invited to talk at a festival, and so on and so forth. There's a lovely poem, I think, might have been a Clive James poem, the title of which is "The Book of My Enemy Has Been Remainded." That's fantastic, I think. But so I'm guilty of feeling those things early in my career. I wasn't making very much money. You know, I'm at the late stage of my career. It's only now that I'm starting to have a sense that I've got a readership. It's only now that I'm starting to make a living as a writer. But it took a very long time to get to this point. You just have to persevere. Back when I used to teach creative writing, in any class of, say, 20 or 25 people, I was teaching adults, I would have one person who I think would be a better writer than me. And I would urge them to send a particular story to a literary magazine, and they would then get rejected by the magazine. And I'd urge them to try other magazines, but no, they would leave the class completely. They would never write again. So you need perseverance and you need a thick skin. You just have to keep doing it.
I think that's great advice. Nowadays, Gary, if authors are lucky, they have a lot of demands in terms of publicity and promotion for their work. The author's kind of sold a bit along with the book. How do you feel about publicity and promotion?
I know how essential it is, but I'm not good at it. I'm shy. In this situation now, I might be coping completely, perfectly well, but I'm tense and I'm anxious and I'm shy. I don't find it an easy thing to do, but it is important, I think. As you say, the author often gets sold. But I have a difficulty there because, you know, I've been a book a year for a very long time now. What new could be said about Gary Ditcher? So often publicists try to hang a hook, a new author, on some aspect of their life. They climbed Kilimanjaro when they were 16, for example. They can't claim anything like that. This old middle-aged geezer, you know, what?
You can't even
can you
climb.
Sell there? So I'm hoping they can sell the book. I want them to sell the book, not me. But it does pay off. I'm with Text Publishing, who've been terrific to me. But for many years, it was just I'd give them a book a year, and with some modest success, I just kept plugging away. But then they really thought I was onto something with the Hirsch novels, and they publicised Peace, the second Hirsch novel, a great deal, and it paid off. It was on bestseller lists and all the rest of it. It was just a very concerted publicity campaign, but it came at a late stage of my writing career. Mm. But it really, really did pay off. But, of course, I can't afford to do that with every book or every author, which is to say it is important, publicity, yeah.
Do you think that, to you, is there a relationship between how a book sells and how you feel about how good it is? Like, are the books that you're proudest of the ones that kind of seem to resonate the most or not? Do you have a favourite book?
Some of my favourite books haven't done quite so well. The Sunken Road. Now, I'm best known as a crime writer, but The Sunken Road is a literary novel. It sank without trace when it was first published in 1996. It had some fantastic reviews. It was nominated for the Booker Prize in England. Was on the short list of an award here in Australia, but really it sank without trace. Fortunately, Text Publishing republished it a couple of years ago. It's found a new lease of life. But it was a book that took me 15 years to write, in the sense that it took me a long while to find my way into it. I wasn't writing it all the time for 15 years, but I would go back to it every now and again for 15 years until I found my voice. Voice again, that's a really crucial thing in fiction. Who's telling the story? What tone are they using? You know, how's the reader getting their information? And I'd love the short stories of Alice Munro, the Canadian writer. She writes about small town, small farm life in southern Ontario. Because I grew up on a small farming region, I wanted to do the same thing about the area where I grew up. And I thought I'd be writing about a farmer. But even though I would love to going home, I'd still call it home, and going out to the paddock with my father and fixing a trough or mending a fence or whatever, what I really liked, I realised, was going home and sitting at the kitchen table with my mother and my sister, listening to the town gossip, the district gossip. That's what I really liked. And I realised then That was the breakthrough for me. I realised the main character was a woman. And I trace her. Most fiction is linear in structure. There's a beginning and a middle and an end, and time is chronological. But with The Sunken Road, it's an experimental novel. Don't be alarmed. It's still easy to read. where I tell her life story over and over again in little five-page chapters. And each chapter is about something different. I give them one where titles like Christmas, birthdays, stone, water, wheat, and I'll take it from childhood to old age over and over again with each little chapter until some of the mysteries of the story, some of the background starts to emerge as the novel progresses and some of the mysteries are solved or explained, rather. So I have a soft spot for that book, which was a flop when it was first published.
That feels like a challenging novel to write, like just from a technical perspective, understanding what you're telling at what time and was that the challenge, do you think?
Yeah, and the challenge not to be too repetitive. Mm-hmm. I do set up a rhythm in the voice. You know, it's the rhythm of the language, of the tone matter in it, but I didn't want it to be too flat. I didn't want it to be too repetitive. So each little chapter had to tell us a different aspect of her childhood, teenage years, married years, old age. Yeah, it was a challenge.
Gary, we always like to get advice for writers on this show. You've given us a lot already, but do you have any advice for writers who are early in their careers? Maybe something you know now that you wished you knew when you were starting out?
It'll be something that happened to me when I went to Stanford University on a writing fellowship. I'd had a few short stories published, and on the strength of these was awarded a scholarship just for 1 year. I jumped in the deep end by giving one of my short stories, which had already been published in a magazine or won an award, I can't remember, a simple story about a young woman going into a pub and seeing her ex-boyfriend across the other side of the pub. And it's a very internal story. She's trying to decide, does she go over and talk to him again? Does she try and hook up again with him? By the end of the story, 10 pages later, she decides, no, she's moved on. She's grown up. So that's the shift. That's all you need in a short story. There doesn't have to be a car chase, just this shift in this very internal story. And it got pulled apart by the class. And someone whose opinion I trusted, because she'd had a few short stories published by The New Yorker, she said, your writing suffers from sensory deprivation. And I was quite crushed. She said it in a friendly way, but I took her to the pub. I said, what do you mean by that? She said that good writing makes pictures in the head. She said, I don't know if that young woman in your story is fat or thin or blonde or brunette, sense of sight. I can't hear the jukebox in the corner of the pub, sense of hearing. I can't smell the cigarette smoke in the bar. I can't taste the salt on the pretzels. I can't feel my feet squelching on the carpet with spilt beer in it. So that was the most useful lesson I've ever had. So now when I'm describing people and places, without ladling on too much sensory information, I do appeal to the reader's sense of hearing or smell or sight or texture. For example, I want the reader to hear, to smell, whatever the smell is. I want the reader to rub their hand over the surface of that object, whatever it is, and feel it too, because then it brings the reader into the scene. So that's my two bobs worth.
I think that's great advice. What is your favourite novel by a debut author?
I think it's probably a book by a Sydney writer or New South Wales writer called Lorraine Peck. And the novel is called The Second Son. It's published by Text. It's a crime novel, but it's also a family dynamics novel. And it won a Ned Kelly Award for Best First Crime Novel. So that's the one I'd recommend.
That's a great recommendation. We've had Lorraine on the show. So readers can read the book and listen to her interview. Gary, I could talk to you for a lot longer, but we will end it there. Thank you so much for your insight today and for talking with me twice.
Thanks, Catherine.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.